have studied five kings of Israel during the same period, Jeroboam, Nadab, Baasha, Elah, Zimron. These arrows indicate specific times when the scripture says there was war between the two kingdoms. Rehoboam versus Jeroboam, Abijah also versus Jeroboam, Asa versus Baasha down here. So there were at least three documented cases of hostility. But I suspect that during the whole 46 years, there was intermittent warfare between the two kingdoms. Now during this period, there were also two invasions from outside of the country. In the days of Asa, an invasion by Zerah the Ethiopian. In the days of Jeroboam, earlier still than Zerah, was an invasion by Pharaoh Shishak. So two invasions from the direction of Africa. But one of them, this invasion affected both kingdoms. This invasion affected only Judah. Alright, then these three words summarize the first 46 years that we've been looking at. The words adjustment, in both kingdoms there were adjustments to be made. And we talked about that the other day. They had to get ready. They had lost territory. They had lost income. There were adjustments that needed to be made. Apostasy. Primarily we think of the apostasy in Israel with the golden calves. But we also need to note, and the verses are printed out in your syllabus, that even under Rehoboam in Judah, that he turned his back upon the Lord to a certain degree, not to the extent that they did in Israel, but nonetheless, he was not completely faithful. His son Abijam followed in his footsteps. It was only Asa who tried to launch a reformation and clean up the country. By the way, somewhere in your notes, I want you to keep a list of the kings of Judah who launched reformations. There are five of them. We'll be coming to. Asa is number one. So keep a list somewhere. Someday I'll ask you to reproduce that list of kings that launched the Reformation. None of the kings in the north. There was never a time in the north when they really tried to have a revival meeting. But in Judah there were five different occasions. Asa is the first. The word attack summarizes this period, and the arrows, I think, make it very clear that we're dealing here at least with five different occasions of attack. And the word anarchy, I think, at least in the northern kingdom, where you have assassinations, we have now one assassination here, two assassinations here, and a suicide. So the throne is changing hands in this first 46-year period. You have three dynasties. You count Amri, you're talking about a fourth dynasty coming to power. So there's anarchy to a large extent in the northern kingdom. So we now hopefully have some mental impression of what was going on in the divided monarchy period for the first 40 or so years. Now today, we're moving forward. Well, there were a couple other footnotes to yesterday's lesson before we move ahead. I wanted to just make a couple of footnotes for you to add to page 240 in your syllabus. One of them is already there, but I want to amplify it under where it says, in Judah, the early years of Rehoboam, about midway down the page. Point C, deserters from the north. Want you to add in there 2 Chronicles 12:12, which tells us that there was an influx of spiritually minded Levites from the northern kingdom who realized that they should come to the south, because that's where the temple was and that's where the people were at least officially committed to the Lord. Although Rehoboam and Abijah left a lot to be desired, officially the nation was committed to the Lord. And the Bible tells us that these citizens from the north strengthened the hands of Rehoboam, gave him spiritual strength, because these were the truly dedicated people from the tribes of the north. I just wanted to add that footnote. And I wanted to reinforce something we said yesterday, just in case you missed it. And that is that this apostasy in Judah under Rehoboam Gaither here was largely due to the influence of his wife, Maacah, the Jezebel of Judah. Now, she is in the background exercising an influence upon, one, her husband, two, her son, Abijam, and three, to a certain extent, even into the reign of King Asa, Asa Mason. And it was Asa who finally rose up and sort of did in his grandmother. All right, now this brings us then to our next period of the divided monarchy. And we're going to use a harp to symbolize this period, because what we have now for the next 40 or so years, a period of harmony between the two kingdoms. And we're going to be looking at now, as we go through the history, we're going to be looking primarily at the rest of the reign of Asa, and then primarily into his son Jehoshaphat, Jehoram, Ahaziah, four kings in Judah, and four kings in Israel, Amri, Ahab, Ahaziah, Jehoram. Now these little symbols that I've drawn on my heart here, the shields represent military alliances. And these are boats, believe it or not. And they represent commercial alliances between Israel and Judah. So what I'm trying to convey by this picture here, this diagram, trying to convey now that we suddenly have a change of policy. Omri, who is absent today, was a military man. We learned yesterday that Omri had to fight for the throne, fight a civil war for 4 years to gain the throne. And some people don't think military men make very good political leaders, but Omri certainly was an exception to that. He was a brilliant politician, a brilliant diplomat. There are no records, really, during his reign. Well, we're going to come back to this. Don't try to copy everything. You'll see this again some more before we're through. But let's look at the career of Omri just briefly here. In the Bible, we only have a handful of verses that talk about Omri. But in secular history, Omri was regarded as one of the greatest of the kings in the north. Now, one thing he did was to enter into a peace with Phoenicia. And that peace, Phoenicia's up here, what's modern-day Lebanon, where all the fighting's going on. That's ancient Phoenicia. And he sealed this peace treaty with Phoenicia by marrying his son Ahab to Jezebel, who was a princess, daughter of Ethbaal from Sidon. And so the peace treaty between these two countries was sealed by marriage. Now that was often done in the ancient world. The thing I want to emphasize here, that if you look at that action from the standpoint of pure politics, it was a brilliant move. We give Omri A+ for political maneuverings, because Israel needed the sea port and the expertise of the Phoenicians as they sailed around the world. They were famous sailors, the greatest sailors of the ancient world. Israel needed that. Damascus, which is over here, was rising to power, becoming a very great economic power in this period. And so to counter that, Israel and Phoenicia entered into this treaty. So politically it was brilliant, but religiously it was disastrous. Because it happens that Jezebel was a missionary. Now, most pagan religions are not very missionary. You stop and look at the history of religions. As a rule, pagan religions are not missionary. Now, there are a few exceptions to that. But the reason being, in the ancient world, that they have the concept, you worship your God, we'll worship ours. Your God's in charge over where you live, our God's in charge where we live. So they could sort of live and let live. But Phoenicia, under Ethbaal and Jezebel, worshipped a god known as Baal Melkart, M-E-L-Q-A-R-T. This particular version of Baal was a evangelistic cult. And we actually find temples of this Baal Melkart all over Syria. And apparently they were really trying to spread the religion of Baal Melkart. And it appears to me from reading the scriptures that when Jezebel became the wife of Ahab and moved over here into Israel, that she was determined to make that religion the religion of Israel. So this is a crucial period in the history of God's dealings with his people. The issue is not just whether Israel is going to remain faithful to the Lord in terms of going through the sacrifices and prayer and all that, but the issue is that Jezebel apparently is trying to move true religion out altogether and replace it with her own Baal worship. Well, one of the things that Omri did, besides entering into this peace treaty with Phoenicia, he also entered into a peace treaty with Judah in the south. Now, they've been fighting around here for over 40 years, but Omri, the military man, the man that you would think would want to continue fighting, enters into a peace treaty with Judah as well. The only military thing that he did during his reign that we know of, he was the one who conquered the region of Moab. He also was a builder. He built a brand new capital at Samaria. Built it from scratch. Archaeology testifies to the fact that the city of Samaria was built right during this period. So he built it from scratch, and it was a magnificent city. The ruins of that city itself are magnificent to behold. His son Ahab would later enlarge the city and expand upon it, but Omri started the project. So he was a great man in a lot of different ways. But the Bible focuses attention not upon Omri, but upon his son Ahab. And whereas Omri only gets to half a dozen verses or so, we have chapters dealing with Ahab. And the reason that so much attention is focused on Ahab and Jezebel is because of this very thing that I just mentioned. The fact that the true religion, true worship of the Lord was hanging in the balance. So it's a crucial time. We're going to be reading in the next few days of a lot of miracles that took place. Miracles in the Bible come in clusters. You don't find miracles on every page of the Bible. Just stop and think back over the years. We've covered centuries already in this course. How many miracles have we studied about? Well, not very many. A few isolated ones here and there. But now we come to a whole cluster of miracles. Why? Because God found it necessary over this period of about 40 years through the prophets Elijah and Elisha to demonstrate his power, his superiority over this god Baal Melchor. So there's a titanic struggle going on for the religious loyalties of the people of Israel during this time. All right, let's talk about Ahab. We print out there on page 243 the verse that says, "There was none like Ahab, which did sell himself to do that which was evil in the sight of the Lord, whom Jezebel, his wife, stirred up. And he did very abominably in following idols, according to all that the Amorites did, whom the Lord cast out before the children of Israel." So during Ahab's reign, we see the spiritual life of the nation going down. Now, who's going to be my Ahab over here? Mr. G, are you going to be sitting where you're sitting from now on? You will be my Ahab. Okay, so we'll want a picture and a poem from you in a day or two here now. All right, we've talked about the entrance of Baalism into the land. We find in the scriptures that temples had been erected for Baal right there in the capital city. We find that temples for the goddess Asherah had also been erected. We find in 1 Kings 16:34 that a fellow by the name of Hiel, H-I-E-L, attempted to rebuild, and did rebuild, the fortifications of Jericho. Now, you remember Joshua had put a curse on anyone who would try to rebuild the walls of Jericho. And this Hiel tried to do that, and he's paid the price. For his sons died in the course of the building of the wall. But the reason I mention it here is that it's another indication that in the days of Ahab, people did not care anymore what God had to say about anything. They no longer feared the Lord. And so even though this curse had stood over anyone who would build and rebuild the city of Jericho, a curse had been put there several hundred years earlier. Yet here's this fellow who dares to try to defy that curse. So it's just another symptom of the attitudes of the people in the northern kingdom during this period. Now another indication of the situation. We find in 1 Kings 18 that Jezebel had launched a persecution against the prophets of God. She had cut off the prophets, is the language that is used. Now here you can see, what was the matter with Ahab? Why wasn't he exercising his authority as king? Well, you can see very clearly that Jezebel was actually running the show there in the northern kingdom during much of this time. Let me ask you this. Who was it there in the royal court that came to the rescue of these prophets, Amy? That is correct. Now, this is not the same Obadiah who wrote the book of Obadiah. A very common name and means servant of the Lord. And there's, I think, 17 or 18 Obadiahs, if I recall correctly. So it's a very common name. It's not the same fellow. But this man was a servant of King Ahab, and he had hidden these kings, 100, or these prophets, 100 of them, 50 in a cave, and had fed them on bread and water during the period of this persecution. Now, I think it's accurate to say that many of the prophets caved in. You know, when you have periods of persecution, we always tend to glamorize and remember the people that stuck it out. The ones who gave their lives, or the ones who somehow survived. But most times in persecution, a good number of people give in. And we're going to be seeing a little bit later here in the northern kingdom a group of prophets who appear to be those who have surrendered and given in to Jezebel and her demands. Now in 1 Kings 17, we're introduced to one of the most dramatic characters in the Bible. He just bursts on the scene of biblical history with no introduction whatsoever. His name is Elijah the Tishbite. And we're going to be studying his career, but he bursts on the scene and announces a famine. Right at the heart of the capital city of Samaria, he says, it's not going to rain, there's not even going to be dew on the ground during the next few years till I say so. Well, of course, I suspect when he first announced that, everybody thought he was a nut. But then he disappeared. God told him to go over here to the brook Kereth, which was not too far from his home at Tishba, called the Tishbite, because he comes from this region. So God tells him to go over here to the brook Kereth, and he'll have water there for a period of time, and he was fed by the ravens. Now, there's some that try to change the wording there, make it read by the Arabians, but I think there's no reason to do that except those that want to get rid of miracles. Apparently these birds are bringing him bits of meat and bread to sustain him during this period. Now, God then is taking care of Elijah. Meanwhile, the famine gets worse and worse over here around Samaria, and according to what we read a little later on, Ahab tries to round up Elijah. He sends to all the neighboring countries, describes Elijah, and says, send this guy back if you've seen him. But he's in hiding, and they don't find him. Now, when the brook Kereth ran dry, God sent Elijah, and this is interesting, clear up into Jezebel country. Zarephath was a city that was really one of the suburbs, you might say, or at least under the authority of King Ethbaal of Sidon. This was Jezebel country. I can imagine that Elijah thought, well, Lord, you really mean what you said. Why would I want to go up there? Jezebel's already killed all the prophets off, and you're sending me right up there into her home territory? Yeah, that's where he wanted him to go. So he goes up there into the region of Sidon, and there he meets a widow who is out gathering sticks. What is she preparing to do, Julie? Alright, she has just enough meal and just enough oil to prepare one last meal for herself and her son. And then she doesn't know what she's going to do because the famine has affected her region of the world as well. And so the prophet tells her, first of all, to give him a drink of water. And as she turns to take care of that, he says, and prepare me a meal too. Give me a little bit to eat. She turns around exasperated, frustrated, explains the situation. Elijah said, in effect, well, don't let that bother you. You go ahead and take care of me. You prepare your meal for you and your son, but you take care of me first. And he goes on to say that the Lord, the bowl of flour shall not be exhausted, nor shall the jar of oil be empty until the day that the Lord sends rain upon the face of the earth. Now, what's that verse really communicating to us? Step out by faith. What made us? God will supply. You can't outgive the Lord. I was thinking about that this morning. I thought maybe we ought to start among our churches the Jar and Bowl Society. The Jar and Bowl Society, made up of people who are committed to the proposition they can't outgive the Lord. The Lord will keep resupplying their needs even as they try to help the needs of this kingdom. That's exactly what we have here. This woman willing to share her last little bit with a prophet of God. And when she did so, she received abundant blessings. At least enough to sustain her. She didn't get rich or anything on it, but she had enough to sustain her during this period of time. Now, while the prophet is staying there in the home of this widow and her son, the son dies. And the woman becomes exasperated, and she almost, it almost appears that she's blaming Elijah, doesn't it? Why would she do that? Bryce? Well, that's an interesting theory. The prophet was eating too much, like a lot of preachers do. Greg, what do you think? Why did the woman blame the prophet for the death of her son?
Well,
why would she think that?
Because he died.
Mr. Depp.
For a punishment for her last sin.
Alright, the concept here seems to be something like this. You are such a righteous man of God. By your presence here, you show me up. By comparison, I'm a sinner. This brings God's attention to my house, and God is punishing me now. Because now, if you hadn't come along, you see, I would have looked good next to my neighbors. But with you here, next to you, my sins become obvious, and God takes notice of me. Now, remember, she's a pagan, as far as I can tell. Comes from a pagan background. So, you know, some of the things she says, you say, well, that doesn't sound just right. Well, of course it doesn't. She's a babe. She's learning faith. I'm sure Elijah was teaching her every day there in the home. But in any case, the son dies, and she blames Elijah for whatever reason. He goes up and stretches out on the child three times. What's behind that? Maiden? Alright, possibly. We don't know for sure, but that seems to be a possibility at least of just simply keeping his body warm in anticipation that God would answer the prayer and restore life to the boy. And then he comes down holding the boy in his arms and gives him to his mother. It was a tremendous day for her, I'm sure. Now, in the third year, chapter 18 tells us that Elijah was directed to go back to have his confrontation with Ahab. Now, there's a little bit of a problem here, but not a big one if you think a little bit. James 5:17 says that it did not rain for 3 years and 6 months. 1 Kings 18:1 says that in the third year, Elijah goes back to have his confrontation with Ahab. Now, and then of course, in that confrontation, the famine ends and so forth. So is that a discrepancy? The one says that the famine lasted 3 years and 6 months, and the other says in the third year, Elijah goes back and they have their confrontation, and that's the end of the famine. How would you reconcile those two passages, Ms. Marshall? Bryce? Okay.
Just like the days, like when Christ
Well, that's what you're saying is true. I don't know if that really solves the problem. But look at the way verse 1 is worded. Now, it came about after many days that the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year. The third year of what? Ah! Doesn't say in the third year of the famine, does it? Could it simply be in the third year of his stay in the region of Sidon? Could it be that the difference in the 3.5 years of James and the third year here is the amount of time that he spent over here at the Brook Kirith? He was in perhaps his third year of staying up there in that area, and then he comes back, but he had spent some time over here. So you add the two together, you get the 3.5 years of the famine, as James indicates there in the New Testament. In any case, he comes back. And what are Ahab and Obadiah doing at the time when Elijah arrives back in the country? Mr. King. What? What about it, Vicki? Yes. Looking for grass to keep the livestock alive. Now, that tells me something about Ahab.
Somebody says he was compassionate to animals.
Yeah, I guess so. But don't you imagine that people were starving to death during this famine? And he's concerned, his primary concern is not finding water, sources of water that his people might have enough to sustain them, but to feed the royal livestock so that he doesn't suffer financial loss in this thing. I think his priorities are all backward. Here they are out looking for grass, looking for water, and Elijah meets with Obadiah. And Obadiah is reluctant to go back and tell the king that he's met Elijah. Why was he reluctant to do that? He said his life would be in jeopardy. But why, pray tell? Mr. Greenwood. All right, do you think that's the reason here, though? Mr. G.
Obadiah thought he went back to tell Ahab, and Ahab kept looking in for Elijah. And when he came back over, Elijah, he had left somewhere, they couldn't find him.
All right, apparently Elijah has a reputation, does he not, for making hasty exits, doing disappearing acts. And Obadiah said, I go tell the king I met you, and I bring him back here, and you're not here. Elijah says, I'll be here. So he goes and gets Ahab and he brings him back. And I really like this confrontation when Ahab first sees Elijah and recognizes him. Is that you, you troubler of Israel? And Elijah answers, it is not I who troubles Israel, but you. But let's not debate that. He says, let's get down to business. And he issues his challenge. He says, get up all the 450 prophets of Baal, the 400 prophets of Asherah, bring them up to Mount Carmel. Let's have a contest and settle this thing. Who's going to be God of Israel? Now, what right did Elijah have to do that? Is that the way we ought to attack missionary enterprises in India? Walk into New Delhi and say, all right, bring all those Buddhist priests and all those Shintoites and all those Confucianites out here, and we'll just have a big contest and settle it all. Yes, that's the point. The text indicates it later, a little bit later on, that God told him to do this. That was his special commission. You and I don't have that kind of commission. Our job is to preach the gospel. That might be a lot slower in some cases. Anyway, Ahab gathers the Baal prophets, brings them to Mount Carmel. No mention is made of the 400 Asherah prophets who ate at Jezebel's table. In other words, she had them on her payroll. Can you imagine the queen supporting 400 pagan prophets? Why weren't the Asherah prophets at Mount Carmel? You think they were scared, all 400 of them? Anybody have another possible explanation? Dan? Possible. Let me ask you this. Do you think Jezebel was the kind of woman that would go along with this confrontation? See, apparently these Asherah prophets were responsible directly to the queen. And I can just see her when the challenge was, she said, no way, none of my men are going out there, that's it. And maybe she did not have direct control of the Baal prophet. But she apparently has direct control of the Asherah. Asherah was a female deity, you see. Apparently the queen was over the prophets of Asherah. And I just probably think she said, that's baloney, we don't get involved in things like that. And perhaps would not, I would suggest that perhaps she did not allow those Asherah prophets to go to Mount Carmel. In any case, when they first arrive on the hill, Elijah challenges them with a question. Why do you halt or limp between two opinions? Why can't you make up your mind who you're going to serve as the Lord? Why do you keep trying to worship both gods at the same time? It's incompatible. You can't do that. You've got to make a wholehearted commitment to one or the other of these gods. And so Elijah lays down the terms of this contest. And what steps did Elijah take to make sure that there was no question of some sort of trickery involved here, Kelly? He did, but not yet. He did something before that. Joan? He let them choose the animal, because had he chosen the animal after the thing was over, they'd say, well, it's obvious that if you chose an animal, our God wouldn't lie. So he said, you choose the animal. Either one. Take either one. You take whatever. Meet the qualifications of your deity. Okay. And then he let them go first. Because had their God answered by fire, of course, that would have settled it. Elijah wouldn't even have had a chance. So he gave them first shot. And he gave them plenty of time. There's no way they could say later on, well, he just didn't give us enough time. Our God would have answered. How long did those rascals pray? All day. And afternoon he began to mock them, didn't he? What were some of the things he said about their deity? Cry a little louder. Maybe he's deaf. Maybe he's asleep. Can't you see Elijah over there just razzing him a little bit? He's been on a trip. Well, actually, if you get into the New Living, have anybody read the Living Bible on that passage? Huh? You have? What does it say, man? Well, the Living Bible captures really the essence of the Hebrew. The common versions have sort of glossed it over a little bit. But the Living Bible is paraphrased. It said maybe he's, I forget the words they used, but it boils down to in the bathroom. I mean, that's not exactly the way it's worded, but it's that idea, you know. He's busy. So Elijah was really needling these guys. Okay. And so then they begin to cut themselves. Oh, they really got in a frenzy. And the idea there is, well, if we shed our blood, our God will look down and he'll be sympathetic and he'll answer. No answer. Then came Elijah's turn, very calmly. The first thing Elijah did, first thing, what was it? Did you notice? It's very simple. You might have overlooked it. Yeah, come over here. No, before that, come over here. Once everybody got close where they can see. He didn't want anybody saying, well, you did some hocus pocus. We couldn't see exactly what you were doing over there. Come on over here, I want you to see this. And then he built up the altar with 12 stones to symbolize again the unity of the nation. Even though the nation at this point was politically divided, Elijah wants them to know that the God of the Old Testament is the God of a united people. Then, of course, they put the bullock on the altar, drowned it with water 3 times, built a trench around it. The trench even flowed with water. Very simple prayer. Boom! Fire came down from heaven, most likely a lightning bolt, and hit that sacrifice, consumed it, and even licked up the water around it. Does it say consume the altar? Well, let's see, you're asking a detail that I didn't really zero in on. What's the verse? 38. Fire of the Lord fell, consumed the burnt offering, the wood, the stone. Yeah, consumed the whole thing. Gobbled the whole thing. All right, let's hear it for the bowl of light. Okay. And then, of course, the people began to say, the Lord is God, the Lord is God. Elijah said, well, if you really believe that, then you gather up these prophets of Baal and do what the Lord God has said in the scriptures. That is, any prophet of a false god who arises in our land is to be executed. If you're really convinced that these men are false prophets and the God that I have served is the true God, then we'll take these guys right down the river Kishon and let them have it. That's exactly what they did. They took them all down there and bumped them off. 400 priestly bodies floated down the river Kishon toward the Mediterranean Sea that day, according to the law of God. That's what the law of God said, that anybody who rose in this land claiming to be a prophet and was a false prophet was to be executed. Well, okay, so that then the prophet Elijah goes to the king and more or less gives him some hope. He says to him, get ready now, we're going to have a big rain, you might as well eat and drink. It's all over, the famine is over. Hadn't rained a drop yet. Famine's over. Then Elijah went up a little bit higher on Mount Carmel. What did he do? What was his prayer posture? You know, you get people that say sometimes, you know, the only way to pray is to pray like this, or some say the only way to pray, you really mean business, you get down on your knees. Well, posture in the scripture, you find all kinds of postures. You find people laying flat on the floor. I came in here one day and found a freshman a few years ago. I thought he died. He was in here praying, stretched right out on the floor, right over in that corner somewhere. I thought the guy was dead. And he was praying. Unusual way to pray, but that's the way he was, because he was praying. And you find that in the scripture. You find him kneeling. You find him standing. You find him with eyes closed and eyes open. In this case, it's the most unusual posture, I think, in the scripture. How was Elijah? What posture was he in as he prayed? He was seated with his head where? Down between his knees. Now, some of us, in the shape we're in, couldn't even get in that position. You know, we had to. I couldn't. But anyway, that's the way he was praying. And seven times he sent his servant on up the hill to look out over the Mediterranean Sea. What do you see? Came back, nothing. Elijah keeps praying. Seven times. Seventh time the guy came back, and what did he say he saw, Kelly?
A
red. We're in the Old Testament. Oh, you read 2 Kings. Oh, boy, you'll be ready for me in about 3 weeks. He said, I saw a cloud about the size of a man's hand.
Lightning.
I thought the fire had fallen again. And so then Elijah goes back to the king. He says, head on back for Jezreel. The rains are on their way. And Elijah then outran Ahab back to Jezreel. Now, I personally, that you could take that to be supernatural strength, and that's possible to interpret that way. I think what happened myself is that the rains came down here in this Kishon Valley, which Ahab would have to travel in back to Jezreel, and his chariot just simply got bogged down in the mud, and that Elijah on foot was able to actually get back to the city before the king did. I don't see this as necessarily a supernatural strength on his part, although it could have been. I don't have a legend on this map. It's not too far from Mount Carmel. Depends on exactly how far up Mount Carmel they were. They'd have to negotiate the hill, getting down the hill, of course, into the valley. But once they got down the valley, it's not all that far. My guess is probably 25, 30 miles. Maybe not that far. It doesn't seem far when you're driving a bus. That's all I know. But this whole valley was very swampy anyway. According to what our guide told us this past summer, I didn't know this. He said in antiquity, this whole valley was rather swampy. There were very few places where you had solid ways to travel. And, of course, today it's all agricultural. And you can't really get that mental picture of how it must have been in Bible days. They hadn't drained the waters off the swamps yet. All right, in your syllabus, notice, of course, there's a mistake on page 245 and several typos in this area. Elijah's flight not to Carmel. He's already been to Carmel. He's going now to Mount Horeb. And let's see how that came about. In chapter 19, when he gets back to Jezreel, Jezebel, he thought, I think Elijah thought, boy, everybody will be converted now. Everybody will follow the Lord. Jezebel says, I'm not converted. Tomorrow by this time, you're going to be dead. Dead. And here was Elijah that just got through facing 400 prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel, and a whole audience of at least neutral people and probably hostile people, and here one woman gives a threat, he takes off. He packs his bag, catches the first airplane sight. How do you figure that? Somebody explain to me how this Elijah, this fearless, courageous, bold prophet, quakes at the threat of a woman. Good point. Alright, I think Pat's suggesting here, you reach a point, you've given your all, you've thrown yourself into a certain project, and you're physically exhausted, you get to the point, you say, what's this? And you've gone through that before exams, you study, your head starts nodding, you find clothes, you go and say, I don't care. That's some of your last dad, buddy. Anybody else with some ideas? Yes, Vicki. Yeah, he knew she meant it. But why wouldn't he stay there and face her down? I think another point is perhaps his physical condition, but I would like to suggest that he was terribly devastated by the idea that the people did not totally respond. He thought this contest on Carmel would turn the whole nation around. Everybody would get behind him, and here it was obvious that the queen and her cronies were not going to back him. I think it's a psychological disappointment. It's the disappointment you feel when you get up and you preach a sermon on a certain subject and you think it's going to settle the problem in the church, and going out the door, one of the elders lets you know in no uncertain terms that your sermon hasn't accomplished a blessed thing. You go home, you say to your wife, faded. Throw in the towel. So I think psychologically there's here. Now tomorrow we'll chase Tracy Elijah down to Mount Horeb, and find out what happens to him down there. Talk about that. Not tomorrow either.
On Monday.
Sorry.